Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Stephen Johnson, whose latest book is The Invention of Air, A Story of Science, Faith, Revolution, and the Birth of America. Earlier books include Interface Culture, Emergence, Mind Wide Open, Everything Bad is Good for You, and The Ghost Map, writer for Discover Magazine, Slate, Wired, co-founded an early webzine, Feed, in 1995, and also founded something called Outside.in, which we'll talk about in a little bit. Reading these two books, Ghost Map, which is the story of cholera and how the cause of cholera was discovered in the mid-1850s, I think, in London, and your new book, Invention of Air, I'm noticing a lot of similarities between them, as well as with your other books. It looks like you're trying to work with what could be called the nexus of science and invention and history at the same time, trying to find those places and people where they all seem to come together in some way.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I mean, on some level, you can look at them and say, what do these books have in common with each other? I mean, there's a book about video games and pop culture, and then about 19th century cholera, and then this new one is in part about 18th century chemistry. But yeah, they do have, I would say, kind of two or three common threads. The first is, exactly as you say, kind of moments where there's some, you know, momentous change in society, or where an interesting idea comes along and manages to kind of struggle to survive and influence people, and to try and kind of, in a sense, tell the story with the idea at the center rather than the people sometimes, although the people are interesting and part of it. And then also to try and connect different disciplines, right, so that Ghost Map is a story in part about public health and epidemiology, but it's also a story about the history of cities. It's also the story about kind of Victorian culture. So there's a lot of Dickens in it. There's some Marx in it. There's, you know, there's Mayhew and all the kind of social critics of that period. I don't know. I've always been interested in trying to kind of approach science and technology issues from kind of I'm an old humanities person, and so I like to kind of bring those things kind of all together rather than have them kind of fight each other.
You use something, an approach you call the long zoom, which is looking at changing flows of energy through natural and human systems.
The question that invention is trying to wrestle with as a kind of a theoretical problem is, when you have, you know, kind of momentous ideas that change the world, and when you have someone like Joseph Priestley, who's kind of the hero of the book, who comes along and is able to do all these extraordinary things and influence all these different fields, you know, you can tell the story of that person's life, and that's interesting, and this happens to be a great story, so it was fun to tell. But I think it's just as important, maybe more important, to ask the question of, why did this happen at this particular time? And what were the things that, you know, were crucial to making it possible for this person to live the life that he did and have the influence that he did? And that's where I think you truly have to be able to kind of zoom out and look at the kind of broader perspective, not just the individual life, but the information networks of the time. The Postal Service plays a huge role. The postal system plays a huge role in what happens in invention and a couple of different points. You have to look at the technology of the day, what kinds of discoveries the technology made possible. And then you have to look at the broader kind of flow of energy through society, because what often happens at crucial turning points in social history is that there's been some change in the availability of energy or the kind of supply of energy that makes.
And you're talking literally
happen.
Energy.
Yeah. So, for instance, Priestley gets supported in a lot of his research in the 1780s by the kind of emerging industrial class of Northern England and Birmingham, the Lunar Society, and people like Josiah Wedgwood and James Watt. And that enables him to do two things. It enables him to put food on the table and do his research without having to have a kind of a day job. And two, it also helps him kind of radicalize his views, because his supporters are both wealthy and opposed to the kind of existing order of things in England. So that has a big impact on his life, and his eventually makes him so controversial that he gets run out of England, which brings him to America. So the question is, why did this happen? And part of that story is that the folks in Northern England happened to be sitting on all these coal deposits that were just this, you know, massive supply of stored energy, without which the Industrial Revolution would not have happened the way that it did, and without which Priestley's life would have been dramatically different. And it happens that those coal deposits formed at a period that's connected to Priestley's own scientific researches and the discovery of oxygen and the way that plants create oxygen. So there's a bit of poetry there. But it's a real causal link, that if those coal deposits hadn't formed 300 million years ago, Joseph Priestley's life would have been different.
then the life of America would have been different, right, because it was directly involved with people like Franklin and Jefferson and Adams. We've gotten so specialized now that we've lost sight of the big picture. Priestley, not only did he, quote, discover oxygen, but he also was a founder of the Unitarian Church. He also was an architect of many of the ideas that found their way into the American Revolution. We look at the people involved in the ghost map, and they were also dealing with social issues as well as finding out what caused or might cure cholera. We don't have that anymore.
To some extent, both books, and particularly Invention of Air, are kind of a celebration of that kind of polymath sensibility of dabbling in lots of different fields. But on the other hand, we can't be too sentimental about it. I mean, the fact that we have had really two centuries of specialization is in large part a sign of progress, right? You have to specialize now. You have to spend 6 years in grad school and 10 years doing, you know, kind of important work before you can really have a breakthrough idea in chemistry. Because we've assembled so much knowledge that it's impossible, as Priestley did, to isolate fundamental gases in your home lab after getting an interest in chemistry 3 years before. You just can't do that anymore. But on the other hand, I think that we do live in an age where it's possible to have kind of an amateur's interest and a kind of a lay interest in lots of different things. And certainly the kind of connectedness of the internet has made it much, much easier to kind of find out about things really quickly. I mean, one of the things that Priestley had to, one of the reasons he met Franklin in the first place is that he wanted to write a book about electricity, but he couldn't get access to any of the papers. He couldn't get access to any of the scholarly work, so much of which was trapped up in the correspondence of the day, with people just writing each other letters about their research. You know, there were no libraries, obviously there was no internet. And so to be a kind of a visionary scientist, yes, it is harder to do that in a number of fields at the same time. And yet, to be able to learn a little bit and be educated and connected about a diverse range of topics, it's actually much easier to do that now.
Now, Stephen Johnson, this book, Invention of Air, focuses, it's not quite a biography,
right,
though it's close to it, focuses on Joseph Priestley as well as this period, let's say 75 to 100 years prior to you, to your earlier book, Ghost Map. How did you get drawn? Were you just drawn to Priestley? Were you drawn to how it all worked together 75 years? How did you come to this book?
Well, I got to it kind of indirectly in that I was going to write a kind of a broader book that was not going to have a kind of a single narrative thread through it about ideas and innovation in general. And I was interested in one of the themes that actually is in this book, which is this idea of, is it useful to think about the flow of information through a society the way that we think about the flow of energy through an ecosystem? We talk kind of casually about a cultural ecosystem. And so I was thinking, well, maybe we could take that a little bit more literally. And so I was doing some research into ecosystem science and earth system science. And in doing that research, I came across this story about Priestley, and I'd known of Priestley as the person who isolated oxygen, allegedly for the first time, which is this kind of complicated story. But what I discovered is that he did this other thing, which I think he deserves more credit for, which is that he was the first person to realize that plants were creating oxygen, and that we have an atmosphere to breathe entirely because the plants generate oxygen as part of photosynthesis. So I thought, well, that'll be an interesting story. Maybe I'll tell that story of that discovery at the very outset of this book. And then I realized that he had this whole connection, though he was British by birth, that he had this whole connection to the American founding fathers, and that he was very close to Franklin, and he had a huge impact on Jefferson. And so suddenly I had this idea that I could write this kind of outsider's founding fathers book that would be kind of a science book mixed with a founding fathers book, seen through the kind of the lens of Priestley's life, not through the lens of Franklin's or Jefferson's or Adams. And that was the point where I was like, okay, actually, this is the book I should write. I'll write this one first, and then I'll write the other book after that. And it was nice because Ghost Map was the first book that I did that had a real historical narrative all the way through it. And I'd had so much fun writing in that mode, kind of writing a book, an idea book wrapped around a story, that I really wanted to do it again. And I actually, Ghost Map was my fifth book, and I felt like kind of an idiot that it took me that long to realize that, you know, people like stories. Narratives are a useful device for the author.
What kind of research was it, mostly online?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There was a big gap between Ghost Map and Invention of Air. They both have fantastic primary sources to support them. Ghost Map had, because there were so many kind of studies done of the outbreak that's at the center of the story, there are just hundreds and hundreds of pages of documents of every little minute detail that you could go back to, in addition to, you know, kind of layers of scholarship that have been done over the years. Invention is really structured, in a sense, on top of the correspondence. It was just great surviving correspondence between Priestley and Franklin, and Priestley and Jefferson, and some between Adams and Priestley. And so you can kind of build the story out of the letters. The difference between the two books is that so much of the stuff was online, in part because of Google Books, and a big change from when I was doing Ghost Map. So I was writing Ghost Map in 2005, basically, and writing this one researching it in 2007, 2008. You know, Priestley wrote something like 500 books and pamphlets over the course of his life, and a huge number of them are now scanned in the public domain, available as downloadable PDFs that you can search in Google, and it would have been very hard to track them down and find all the text you were looking for in these ancient volumes. And now it's just a few keystrokes away. So it was great. It's a great change.
Based upon that, we're entering a new kind of information age, which is kind of sub rosa to the information age we think we're looking at.
Well, yeah, it's part of this idea of kind of reviving all this knowledge that's been trapped in books. Because one of the things that happened with Google is people became so dependent on Google, it skewed everybody's kind of information needs away from books towards things that had somehow been ported to the web or originated on the web. So suddenly, you know, you were much more likely to cite something that had been published in a blog than you were to have something published in a...
Or Wikipedia.
Or Wikipedia than something published in a book. And so I think, you know, it's important that Google has done this. They've had some very complicated issues with the Authors Guild about the rights issues and things like that. I mean, I'm a great believer in the blogosphere, and I'm a blogger myself and all of that. But overall, the quality standards are higher in the book world than I think in the blogosphere. And so to have our primary kind of conduit for all that information kind of pushing us towards the blogosphere and away from the books, I think has skewed things. And so hopefully we're starting to get back to books in this new revitalized form online.
I was just editing an old interview I did about 18 years ago, and I realized that interview, which was with Michael Crichton, concerned what he did. Well, all of that information now is online. I wouldn't have to ask him those questions. I could ask other questions about what he did.
Right.
It's a big change.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I wonder, getting back to everything bad is good for you, maybe it's something that we're just not looking at.
I have a bit of that kind of sensibility when I think about somebody like Priestley writing so many books over the course of his life, not only without the internet, but without a computer. And my whole writing and researching and thinking process is so much bound up in, you know, I think I spent a lot of time thinking about how to use the computer in a good way and how to use the internet in a good way. And it's not something that I think comes, you know, naturally. It's why teaching kind of information literacy is an important part of the kind of new media revolution. It's not that the kids are obviously incredibly good at adapting to it and figuring out new uses for it, but we also need to teach part of this as well. But I think about somebody who was so productive who had none of these things, and it just seems astonishing to me that he ever wrote a single book, much less 500.
Well, but he also wasn't distracted by 5,000 movies, television sets, and all of that. He had the time. You know, back in 100 years ago, everybody knew the piano because they didn't have stereo, so people knew how to play the piano.
That was how you got music. Well, it's funny. One of the things I kind of discovered late in the research of this book is that Priestley apparently played 2 to 3 hours of games every day, whether it was chess or backgammon or whist and things like that. It was a big game player with his family, with his wife. And I thought I stumbled across another kind of validation of the everything bad is good for you thesis, that as long as you play games every day, it was good for your brain.
Kind of funny thing, though, in looking at this, how people also, despite their open-mindedness, they latch onto a particular idea, a bad idea, and don't give it up. In the case of Priestley, it was phlogiston. In the case of Jon Snow, who was willing to go the extra mile to discover the cause of cholera, it was the miasma theory, both of which turned out to be incredibly wrong. And I wonder if there are any analogs to that today.
I think there probably are. The problem is that they're just hard to see. I mean, the miasma theory, you know, is one of the big themes of that book, because I think it's a great – when we teach the history of ideas, when we talk about intellectual history, we have this tendency to teach the good ideas and to focus on the good ideas. And in part, both these books are about good ideas. But I think it's just as important to teach – the bad ideas that stuck around too long, as you kind of said. I called it in Ghost Map the sociology of error. The miasma theory, which basically held that the ultimate cause of disease was kind of contaminated air, and that it was coming through smells, basically. And if you could get rid of smells, people would be better, which turned out to be almost entirely wrong and led to some terrible public health interventions. At one point, they emptied out all the cesspools in everybody's basements into the Thames, basically, to clean up the air inside their houses, which, of course, poisoned the water supply. So one big question is, you know, why do ideas like that stick around for as long as they do? Because no doubt we have, as you say, you know, our own misconceptions that we kind of can't see, or we'll look back 50 years from now and be like, oh, my God, I can't believe we thought that. But they're hard to see. I mean, that's the issue with them, is that they, you know, it's hard to kind of figure out what the blind spots are, because that's why they're blind spots.
I would say that 5 years ago we could have said every conservative thought about the value of complete free market economics.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, that maybe that we had briefly kind of a consensus that going as unregulated as possible and letting markets do all the work, you know, is the way to go. And it's not that the entire country was there, but there was kind of a center left to right consensus that was always the case. And there was that moment, you know, early after the crash in the fall when Greenspan was testifying, and he had that line where he said, yes, I found a flaw in my theory. And I feel like that's one of the things we're going to look back on, is like when Greenspan finally saw that there was just a flaw. He was like, I don't know what it is yet, but there was a flaw.
21st century phlogiston, I guess.
Exactly.
You're listening to an interview with Stephen Johnson, whose latest book is The Invention of Air. You talk about these different theories, putting it all in this long zoom approach. We've got the great man theory and relationship to social intellectual history. What about the idea of general sea changes, and do they really exist? So we can go from suddenly a conservative country under Bush a year ago or a year and a half ago to suddenly a liberal country under Obama. Is there a change? What's going on? I mean, I'm trying to put that in this context, then.
Yeah, it's hard to tell sometimes, and it's particularly hard to tell. I often feel when I look back at this period that we had such a distorting effect in the general kind of political sensibility of the country because of 9/11. Because of two things, basically. Because Bush somehow managed to win in 2000 and then happened to be president during 9/11, and 9/11 was so traumatic. But that if you think that Gore really did win that election, narrowly, but won it, and thus if you assume that 9/11 would have happened the way it did, Gore would have been an immensely popular president, would have certainly been reelected. And then we would actually have a period of time where basically the Democrats would have held the White House for at least 16 years, and who knows what would have happened, you know, in this election, and maybe there would have been a backlash. But, you know, I think what happened was, you know, we were a country that was moving leftward under Clinton in general, and Clinton left office as one of the most popular presidents in history. And then we had this kind of once-in-a-lifetime event where there happened to be a Republican president who really shouldn't have been president. And, you know, it took us a little bit of time, but we eventually realized that he was really a horrible, horrible president, and the policy that's enacted. And I always think about Bush. I think about there was a parody that they did on Saturday Night Live during the Bush-Gore battle where they imagined the two different scenarios. The Gore scenario was Gore had installed these giant old computers in the White House, and he was giving the nation weekly tests. In the Bush scenario, you can see that Washington is ablaze in the background, and he started drinking again. And his first line to America is, I broke the Hoover Dam. And I kind of feel like that's kind of what happened, you know. And so we've gotten to this point where we're like, okay, we're not going to buy that anymore. We're not going to buy the free market kind of open ideology anymore. And we know we have to be better citizens in the kind of global sphere. And we know we have to be smarter about science and technology, a theme of Invention of Air. So I think we maybe have the opportunity for a consensus that we are actually a center-left country and not a center-right country. But we'll see.
There's another area of the Invention of Air which discusses the idea of political figures being knowledgeable about science. And I know in an interview you talked about how unthinkable it would be for the founding fathers to have somebody, I think it was either Romney or Huckabee, suddenly say, I don't need to know about science, I'm the president.
Huckabee said it in a CNN debate. He was asked about his belief in evolution and or lack thereof. And Huckabee said, listen, you know, I'm surprised you even asked me this question. I'm asking to be president. I'm not writing an eighth grade science curriculum. That joke would even make sense is really kind of striking. I mean, if you had asked him, you know, a foreign policy question, he wouldn't have said, why are you asking me that? I don't want to write an eighth grade international affairs textbook. I just want to be president. Somehow it's possible to kind of separate out some kind of knowledge of science and technology from the kind of worldview that we think our political leaders should have. And think of all the issues today that revolve in some way around science or technological issues, whether it's energy issues and environmentalism and stem cell and genomics and all the things that computer science has wrought in the form of the internet. So one of the points of this book is as a reminder to people in putting the kind of context of the founding fathers and their relationship to someone like Priestley and how interested they were in science and how interested they were in new technologies, that when we have a leader like Huckabee, when we have leaders like Bush who take these anti-science positions or take these kind of know-nothing positions in regards to this stuff, that they're not just being anti-intellectual and they're not just being irresponsible. Like on some basic level, they're being un-American. They're betraying kind of the values that were really central to the founders.
At the same time, the anti-intellectuals have always been on the march against people pushing against change. The riot and fire that you described that forced Priestley to come to America, mm-hmm. I mean, this stuff was going on in the 1700s in England.
Yeah. That's why you got to take a side. For me, you write a book to say, listen, let's be on the side of progress and change and a kind of progress that Priestley really believed. And one of the things I think is so moving about Priestley is that he was a great optimist. And he had all these terrible things on some level that happened to him over the course of his life, but he was so kind of continually upbeat despite the fact that there were mobs burning down his house, driving him out of England, and he almost got arrested during the Alien Sedition Acts here in the United States. But he always believed that fundamentally that there was this kind of march of progress that society was on and that enlightened kind of inquiry and reason and rationality, if you had an open debate about things, eventually that it would win out and society would improve. It's a good tone. It's a good thing to shoot for, I think, as progressive people, to believe that that's possible.
Do you?
Yeah, I do. You know, most of my books have erred on the optimistic side of things, and Everything Bad is Good for You was certainly a case of saying, listen, let's stop worrying about, you know, what the kids are watching on TV or the games they're playing, because, you know, in a sense, we have bigger problems. We do have some real problems, but the kids are going to be fine, because compared to what I was doing when I was 8, which was watching The Love Boat or something like that, I mean, the television is much better. The games are far more complicated and challenging and enriching, and the internet is this incredible new mechanism for self-expression and for connecting people and, you know, finding new ideas, in addition to all the garbage that's out there. And so we have a lot of reason to be optimistic about the state of media right now, for instance. And so we can take that off our list of kind of worries, basically, I think.
Do you really? I mean, even with the corporatization and the dumbing down.
I think that the trend is not a universal dumbing down. I don't accept that. What I think has happened is there is more of everything. And so you can look out there and you can say there's more, you know, idiotic stuff. There's more spam. There's more porn. There's more of that. But there's also far more great stuff. It's not that we're trending in one direction. It's just the ecosystem is, in a sense, getting more diverse, right, in that kind of ecosystem metaphor. And so we have to then push ourselves and push the society towards the more interesting stuff that's out there. But if you go back and look at the pop culture kind of landscape in the mid-70s, I mean, we forget how dismal it was. I mean, it was people watching Three's Company. It was people watching Happy Days. You know, we talk about, you know, the news, Fox News and things like that, but there were – it wasn't really possible to get news on television other than for 30 minutes at night. So there's a lot that's gotten better, and we just need to keep reminding ourselves of that.
There's also been a shift. The great invention at the time in the 70s was film, and now it's cable TV, it's Mad Men, it's The Wire.
Yeah, certainly the top echelon of television kind of dramas has never been better. I mean, you know, the shows like The Wire, I mean, clearly some of the best shows that ever been done, and stuff on HBO, but also even a show like Lost is a fantastic work of television, much more complicated and challenging and rich than anything that was on the air. You know, even something like Hill Street Blues. Lost is far more challenging mentally to watch than a show like Hill Street Blues. Work of television, much more complicated and challenging and rich than anything that was on the air. You know, even something like Hill Street Blues. Lost is far more challenging mentally to watch than a show like Hill Street Blues.
Stephen Johnson, a couple other questions. What is Outside In?
Outside In, one of the weird things about my career is that I keep starting these kind of web projects that are thematically related to the book that I happen to be writing. And so Outside In is something that I co-created with a few folks right as I was finishing Ghost Map. And it was really spawned by this realization I had, where I realized when I would sit down to write Ghost Map, the thing I would do to kind of distract myself from actually having to write was I would go and read all these local bloggers who were writing about kind of the neighborhood scenes where I live in Brooklyn, and kind of brownstone Brooklyn. And I realized that they were kind of covering my immediate world, my kind of geographic world, in this way that The New York Times wasn't covering, and The Voice wasn't covering, and The New Yorker wasn't covering. So I had this idea that it would be pretty interesting to use the web to connect all those different voices and to basically find everything they were writing about that was related to some kind of location, and then tag that little piece of information with enough geographic data so that you could start to say, show me everything that's being said within 1,000 feet of my house, or show me everything that's been said about the public school where my kids go to, or this playground that's being put in, or this mugging that happened down the street from me. That happened to be a kind of query that Google actually couldn't answer. It's in that zone. Google will tell you where the nearest Italian restaurant is, but they won't tell you like what people are saying about your block. And so we created this site, outside.in, and it's been really fun. I mean, I ran it for about a year, and now we found a wonderful CEO to run it, and now I'm the executive chairman, and we've got great investors, and we're basically trying to organize as much information as we can find across the country, you know, pretty much every market that has something to do with location and kind of neighborhood discussions.
What was Feed?
Feed was one of the first, if not the first, general interest online magazines, web magazines that had no kind of print equivalent. So I started it when I was in grad school. It kind of distracted me from doing my dissertation ultimately. And we had a great run. We did it from 95 until about 2001. A lot of young writers who've gone on to have nice careers were published first. Like people like Josh Marshall, who does Talking Points Memo, used to do politics for us, and Anna Marie Cox, who did Wonkat and has now become a kind of a political celebrity, was our TV critic for a while. So we had a lot of fun. Sadly, entirely due to my incompetence, the archives are not online right now. I have to get them back online one of these days. But it was a great chapter in my life.
When you're talking about technology, do you think it's easier, harder, impossible to predict the future?
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, you know, there's that saying people often have that we, you know, overestimate the change in the short term and underestimate it in the long run. And I think that often happens. I mean, you get a kind of a hunch. I mean, I've been lucky/smart at a couple of points where I've felt that you could see something that was coming.
Like what?
Well, my first two books, Interface Culture, had a whole kind of anticipation of what would become blogs. And it was basically saying, you know, in a medium that's built around links, you're going to have people who are good at linking. And they're going to become the kind of specialists, and they're going to start, you know, their craft is not going to be writing articles, but really just kind of coming up with links and kind of commentary on links. And so I had a kind of description of what that ecosystem would look like that turned out to be, I'll say myself, exactly right. And Emergence, the next book, was really about bottom-up systems that kind of organized from below and that talked about a lot of the issues that then became what we now call Web 2.0. And you could see those things, and there were the beginnings of those things in the technology world at that point. It wasn't like I was inventing it from scratch, but you could just take a kind of an early trend and just say, okay, imagine that carried out to its kind of logical extreme. Because one of the things you can kind of guarantee about the Internet is that everything will be taken to its logical extreme. And so just whether that extreme is going to be interesting to people is the question, but someone will take it.
William Gibson, after writing Neuromancer, I asked him last year, about the predictive. He predicted the Internet and all. He said, yeah, but I miss cell phones. And not long ago, I was watching Back to the Future 2, which had flying cars in like 2013, but also missed cell phones.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's in the original Star Wars, which is funny because this is one of the things that Lucas didn't fix when he redid the technology. Is, you know, they have all this incredible technology. They can go at the speed of light, but their interfaces on their computers are still little, you know, kind of like these vector graphics with, they don't even have color. And I thought it was striking that he didn't actually update those screens, because that's the thing that looks the most dated in a way. I mean, the special effects look a little bit dated, but the anticipation of what future graphic interfaces will look like was just completely off.
What amazed me in reading The Invention of Air is how all of these people, Franklin, Priestley, all of them had this idea that things would expand exponentially in really extraordinary ways. They were right there then. I mean, we're just kind of like looking back at them and going, holy crap.
Yeah. No, they really did. I mean, Priestley, he described it as kind of this sublime feeling, which is a nice word because it's both an Enlightenment word and a Romanticism word, but that the feeling you get when you contemplate, when you look back at the progress a society has made over the last 100 years, and then you think about how far they're going to get in the next 200 years or something, that is this kind of awe-inspiring thing to contemplate. And for Priestley, it was actually kind of a religious feeling. He saw it as kind of, that was the work of God, is this progress of enlightenment that we were able to see. But those are very kind of moving passages to me, I think.
Well, he also seemed to have predated the Gaia theory as well, seeing ecosystems.
Yeah, I mean, that insight that plants are creating our oxygen and that's a kind of a global phenomena, not just something that was happening in the lab, but something happening all around the planet. That idea was truly a collaboration between Priestley and Franklin. And that's one of the things I love about the story, is that there's this kind of beautiful duet between the two men where Priestley does the experiment and then Franklin suggests this kind of global implication to it. That's one of the things, I mean, not that Franklin needs to pad his resume, but we don't actually think of him as also the father of, you know, modern ecosystem science, but I think he should at least have, you know, a little bit of a role in that story.
Let's forward 200 years on ecosystems. You're an optimistic guy. I think the thing about these books, these last three books, all of them, is the inherent optimism. Mm. All of these things are good for us. People can figure things out about science, about disease. And then we come to the ecosystem and global warming. People trying to rein in the ideas of, say, progress on why should we go to the moon if we can't even keep our atmosphere from destroying cities by the shore, you know?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's true. Well, I mean, I think that, and this is the ghost map kind of ends on a bit of that note, which is to say, we have to agree, we have to get to the consensus, which I think we're getting to finally, that we have a problem. I mean, the worst thing about the anti-environmentalists and the global warming kind of naysayers is that they stalled the debate. I mean, it's a bit like what folks have tried to do with intelligent design, which is to say, hey, let's just have a debate about whether global warming is even happening. And then they say, okay, all right, it is happening, but let's have a debate about whether it's man-made. And so you spend 10 years, you know, kind of locked in this debate where half the country is listening to their leaders who are saying, we don't even know if it's proven. You know, we're not even sure that this is real. And if we had just made an earlier assessment saying, this is real, it's a big deal, and we got to start to think about how to solve it, we would be further along in this process. You know, so we have to get to that point. It seems like we're getting to that point. But I think if we take these problems seriously and we agree that we're going to go try and figure out a solution for it, it's possible. It's within our grasp. There's a great book by the British science writer Oliver Morton, also on kind of the theme of photosynthesis, called Eating the Sun, that is amazingly optimistic about all the kind of technologies that are conceivable having to do with solar. There's just an immense amount of energy that is every single second flowing to the Earth that is kind of effectively bouncing off Earth and going out. And if we could figure out a way to tap that, which no doubt we can if we put our minds to it, we'll solve a lot of our energy needs and we'll be able to grow. One of the things people don't talk about enough is, you know, it looks like all the kind of demographers seem to mostly agree that we're not going to have runaway population growth forever, in part because of urbanization, that the planet's population is probably going to stabilize in around 2050. And so we don't have that problem of, like, we're going to have more and more people forever. We're probably going to start having a shrinking population at that point. But they're just going to have more and more per capita kind of energy needs, and so we're going to have to figure out how to handle that. I think we can. We just have to think about it seriously.
And we have to deal with the carbon that's already there. That carbon under the ground that was so good to Priestley, to Joseph Priestley, coming up into the air, destroys the environment.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That part of it is not great news, but we're going to have to just figure out a way to handle it and get off of those things. I mean, get off of that carbon dependence. There's no question about it.
Stephen Johnson, now you've got the invention of air and you're turning outside.in to other people. What are you up to now?
I'm going to go back in and write the book that I was originally going to write, because I'm still under contract to write that one. I didn't rip up that contract. I just said I was going to write another one. And so I'm going to do this book, which I think in some ways will be the, you know, is a kind of a bigger book about ideas and innovation. I kind of see Invention, Ghost Map, and then that book is almost kind of like a trilogy that are all on this theme, with the first two as kind of stories leading up to the bigger picture of the final one. But I really haven't had a lot of time to think about it because I've been so busy on tour for this book.
What I'm looking at here is, in a way, what you're heading toward is trying to find some kind of unified field theory of ideas, which is pretty hard to do.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll get all the way there, but if I get a non-unified partial theory of ideas, I think I'll be happy.
You've been listening to an interview with Stephen Johnson, whose latest book is The Invention of Air. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.